This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Magician's Land by Lev Grossman. Read for you by Mark Bramhall. Further Up and Further In. C.S. Lewis, The Last Battle. Chapter 1. The letter had said to meet in a bookstore. It wasn't much of a night for it. Early March, drizzling and cold, but not quite cold enough for snow. It wasn't much of a bookstore, either. Quentin spent 15 minutes watching it from a bus shelter at the edge of the empty parking lot, rain drumming on the plastic roof and making the asphalt shine in the streetlights. Not one of your charming, quirky bookstores, with a ginger cat on the windowsill and a shelf of rare signed first editions and an eccentric, bewhiskered proprietor behind the counter. This was just another strip mall outpost of a struggling chain, squeezed in between a nail salon and a party city, 20 minutes outside Hackensack, off the New Jersey Turnpike. Satisfied, Quentin crossed the parking lot. The enormous, bearded cashier didn't look up from his phone when the door jingled. Inside, you could still hear the noise of cars on the wet road, like long strips of paper tearing one after another. The only unexpected touch was a wire birdcage in one corner, but where you would have expected a parrot or a cockatoo inside, there was a fat, blue-black bird instead. That's how uncharming this store was. It had a crow in a cage. Quentin didn't care. It was a bookstore, and he felt at home in bookstores, and he hadn't had that feeling much lately. He was going to enjoy it. He pushed his way back through the racks of greeting cards and cat calendars, back to where the actual books were, his glasses steaming up and his coat dripping on the thin carpet. It didn't matter where you were. If you were in a room full of books, you were at least halfway home. The store should have been empty, coming up on 9 o'clock on a cold, rainy Thursday night, but instead it was full of people. They browsed the shelves, silently, each one on his or her own, slowly wandering the aisles like sleepwalkers. A jewel-faced girl with a pixie cut was reading Dante in Italian. A tall boy with large, curious eyes who couldn't have been older than 16 was absorbed in a Tom Stoppard play. A middle-aged black man with elfin cheekbones stood staring at the biographies through thick, iridescent glasses. You would almost have thought they'd come there to buy books, but Quentin knew better. He wondered if it would be obvious, if he would know right away, or if there would be a trick to it, if they'd make him guess. He was getting to be a pretty old dog, he'd be 30 this year, but this particular game was new to him. At least it was warm inside. He took off his glasses and wiped them with a cloth. He'd just gotten them a couple of months ago, the price of a lifetime of reading fine print, and they were still an unfamiliar presence on his face, a windshield between him and the world, always slipping down his nose and getting smudged when he pushed them up again. When he put them back on, he noticed a sharp-featured young woman, girl next door pretty, if you happen to live next door to a grad student in astrophysics. She was standing in a corner paging through a big, expensive, architectural-looking volume, Piranesi drawings, vast, shadowy vaults and cellars and prisons haunted by great wooden engines. Quentin knew her. Her name was Plum. She felt him watching her and looked up, raising her eyebrows in mild surprise, as if to say, "You're kidding. You're in on this thing, too?" He shook his head once, very slightly, and looked away, keeping his face carefully blank. Not to say, "No, I'm not in on this. I just come here for the novelty coffee mugs and their trenchant commentary on the little ironies of everyday life." What he meant was, "Let's pretend we don't know each other." It was looking like he had some time to kill, so he joined the browsers, scanning the spines for something to read. The fillery books were there, of course, shelved in the young adult section, repackaged and rebranded with slick new covers that made them look like supernatural romance novels. But Quentin couldn't face them right now. Not tonight. Not here. He took down a copy of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold instead and spent 10 contented minutes at a checkpoint in gray 1950s Berlin.
"Attention, book bumblers, patrons,"
the cashier said over the PA, though the store was small enough that Quentin could hear his unamplified voice perfectly clearly.
"Attention! Book bumblers will be closing in 5 minutes. Please make your final selections."
He put the book back. An old woman in a beret that looked like she'd knitted it herself bought a copy of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie and let herself out into the night. So, not her. The skinny kid who'd been camped out cross-legged in the graphic novels section, reading them to rags, left without buying anything. So, not him either. A tall, bluff-looking guy with Cro-Magnon hair and a face like a stump who'd been furiously studying the greeting cards, pretty clearly overthinking his decision, finally bought one. But he didn't leave. At 9 o'clock exactly, the big cashier closed the door and locked it with a final, fateful jingle, and suddenly Quentin was all nerves. He was on a carnival ride and the safety bar had dropped, and now it was too late to get off. He took a deep breath and frowned at himself, but the nerves didn't go away. The bird shuffled its feet in the seeds and droppings on the bottom of its cage and squawked once. It was a lonely kind of squawk, the kind you'd hear if you were out by yourself on a rainy moor, lost, with darkness closing in fast. The cashier walked to the back of the store. He had to excuse himself past the guy with the cheekbones, and opened a gray metal door marked Staff Only.
"Through here."
He sounded bored, like he did this every night, which for all Quentin knew he did. Now that he was standing up, Quentin could see that he really was huge, 6'4" or 5" and deep-chested, not pumped, but with broad shoulders and that aura of slow inexorability that naturally enormous men have. His face was noticeably asymmetrical. It bulged out on one side as if he'd been slightly overinflated. He looked like a gourd. Quentin took the last spot in line. He counted 8 others, all of them looking around cautiously and taking exaggerated care not to jostle one another as if they might explode on contact. He worked a tiny revelation charm to make sure there was nothing weird about the door. He made an okay sign with his thumb and forefinger and held it up to one eye like a monocle.
"No magic,"
the cashier said. He snapped his fingers at Quentin.
"Guy, hey, no spells, no magic."
Heads turned.
"Sorry?"
Quentin played dumb. Nobody called him Your Majesty anymore, but he didn't think he was ready to answer to Guy yet. He finished his inspection. It was a door and nothing more.
"Cut it out. No magic."
Pushing his luck, Quentin turned and studied the clerk. Through the lens he could see something small shining in his pocket, a talisman that might have been related to sexual performance. The rest of him shone, too, as if he were covered in phosphorescent algae. Weird.
"Sure."
He dropped his hands, and the lens vanished.
"No problem."
Someone rapped on the window pane. A face appeared, indistinct through the wet glass. The cashier shook his head, but whoever it was rapped again, harder. He sighed.
"What the shit?"
He unlocked the front door and, after a whispered argument, let in a man in his 20s, dripping wet, red-faced but otherwise sportscaster handsome, wearing a windbreaker that was way too light for the weather. Quentin wondered where he'd managed to get a sunburn in March. They all filed into the back room. It was darker than Quentin expected, and bigger, too. Real estate must come cheap out here on the turnpike. There were steel shelves crammed full of books flagged with fluorescent-colored stickies, a couple of desks in one corner, the walls in front of them shingled with shift schedules and taped-up New Yorker cartoons, stacks of cardboard shipping boxes, a busted couch, a busted armchair, a mini-fridge. It must have doubled as the break room. Half of it was just wasted space. The back wall was a steel shutter that opened onto a loading dock. A handful of other people were coming in through another door in the left-hand wall, looking just as wary. Quentin could see another bookstore behind them, a nicer one with old lamps and oriental rugs, probably a ginger cat, too. He didn't need magic to know that it wasn't a door at all, but a portal to somewhere else, some arbitrary distance away. There! He caught a telltale hairline seam of green light along one edge. The only thing behind that wall, in reality, was Party City. Who were they all? Quentin had heard rumors about dog and pony shows like this before, gray market cattle calls, work for hire, but he'd never seen one himself. He definitely never thought he'd go to one, not in a million years. He never thought it would come to that. Stuff like this was for people on the fringes of the magical world, people scrabbling to get in, or who'd lost their footing somehow and slipped out of the bright, warm center of things, all the way out to the cold margins of the real world. All the way out to a strip mall in Hackensack in the rain. Things like this weren't for people like him. Except now, they were. It had come to that. He was one of them. These were his people. 6 months ago he'd been a king in a magic land, another world, but that was all over. He'd been kicked out of Fillory, and he'd been kicked around a fair bit since then, and now he was just another striver, trying to scramble back in, up the slippery slope, back toward the light and the warmth. Plum and the man with the iridescent glasses sat on the couch. Redface took the busted armchair. Pixie Cut and the teenage stoppard reader sat on boxes. The rest of them stood. There were 12, 13, 14 in all. The cashier shut the gray door behind them, cutting off the last of the noise from the outside world, and snuffed out the portal. He'd brought the birdcage with him. Now he placed it on top of a cardboard box and opened it to let the crow out. It looked around, shaking first one foot, then the other, the way birds do.
"Thank you all for coming," it said. "I will be brief."
That was unexpected. Judging from the ripple of surprise that ran through the room, he wasn't the only one. You didn't see a lot of talking birds on Earth. That was more of a Fillorian thing.
"I'm looking for an object," the bird said. "I will need help taking it from its present owners."
The bird's glossy feathers shone darkly in the glow of the hanging lights. Its voice echoed in the half-empty stockroom. It was a soft, mild-mannered voice, not hoarse at all like you'd expect from a crow. It sounded incongruously human. However it was producing speech, it had nothing to do with its actual vocal apparatus. But that was magic for you.
"So, stealing," an Indian guy said.
Not like it bothered him. He just wanted clarification. He was older than Quentin, 40 maybe, balding and wearing an unbelievably bad multicolored wool sweater.
"Theft," the bird said.
"Yes."
"Stealing back or stealing?" "What is the difference?"
"I would merely like to know whether we are the bad guys or the good guys. Which of you has a rightful claim on the object?"
The bird cocked its head thoughtfully.
"Neither party has an entirely valid claim," it said. "But if it makes a difference, our claim is superior to theirs."
That seemed to satisfy the Indian guy, though Quentin wondered if he would have had a problem either way.
"Who are you?"
somebody called out. The bird ignored that.
"What is the object?"
Plum asked.
"You'll be told after you've accepted the job."
"Where is it?" Quentin asked. The bird shifted its weight back and forth.
"It is in the northeastern United States of America."
It half spread its wings in what might have been a bird shrug.
"So you don't know," Quentin said. "So finding it is part of the job."
The bird didn't deny it. Pixie Cut scooched forward, which wasn't easy on the broken-backed couch, especially in a skirt that short. Her hair was black with purple highlights, and Quentin noticed a couple of blue star tattoos peeking out of her sleeves, the kind you got in a safe house. He wondered how many more she had underneath. He wondered what she'd done to end up here.
So we're finding, and we're stealing, and I'm guessing probably doing some fighting in between. What kind of resistance are you expecting?
Can you be more specific?
Security. How many people? Who are they? How scary? Is that specific enough?
Yes. We are expecting two.
Two magicians?
Two magicians plus some civilian staff. Nothing out of the ordinary, as far as I know.
As far as you know,
the red-faced man guffawed loudly. He seemed on further examination to be a little insane.
I do know that they have been able to place an incorporate bond on the object. The bond will have to be broken, obviously.
A stunned silence followed this statement. Then somebody made an exasperated noise. The tall man who'd been shopping for greeting cards snorted as if to say, "Can you believe this shit?"
"Those are supposed to be unbreakable," Plum said coolly.
"You're wasting our time,"
iridescent glasses said.
"An incorporate bond has never been broken," the bird said, not at all bothered.
Or were its feathers just slightly ruffled?
"But we believe that it is theoretically possible, with the right skills and the right resources. We have all the skills we need in this room."
"What about the resources?" Pixie-Cut asked.
"The resources can be obtained."
"So that's also part of the job," Quentin said. He ticked them off on his fingers. "Obtaining the resources, finding the object, breaking the bond, taking the object, dealing with the current owners. Correct?"
"Yes. Payment is $2 million each, cash or gold. $100,000 tonight, the rest once we have the object. Make your decisions now. Bear in mind that if you say no, you will find yourself unable to discuss tonight's meeting with anyone else."
Satisfied that it had made its case, the bird fluttered up to perch on top of its cage. It was more than Quentin had expected. There were probably easier and safer ways in this world for a magician to earn $2 million, but there weren't many that were this quick, or that were right in front of him. Even magicians needed money sometimes, and this was one of those times. He had to get back into the swim of things. He had work to do.
"If you're not interested, please leave now," the cashier said.
Evidently, he was the bird's lieutenant. He might have been in his mid-twenties. His black beard covered his chin and neck like brambles. The Cro-Magnon guy stood up.
"Good luck."
He turned out to have a thick German accent.
"You're gonna need this, huh?"
He skimmed the greeting card into the middle of the room and left. It landed face up. "Get well soon." Nobody picked it up. About a third of the room shuffled out with him, off in search of other pitches and better offers. Maybe this wasn't the only show in town tonight. But it was the only one Quentin knew about, and he didn't leave. He watched Plum, and Plum watched him. She didn't leave either. They were in the same boat. She must be scrabbling, too. The red-faced guy stood against the wall by the door.
"See ya,"
he said to each person as they passed him.
"Bye-bye."
When everybody who was going to leave had left, the cashier closed the door again. They were down to eight. Quentin, Plum, Pixie, Redface, Iridescent Glasses, the teenager, the Indian guy, and a long-faced woman in a flowing dress with a lock of white hair over her forehead. The last two had come in through the other door. The room felt even quieter than it had before, and strangely empty. "Are you from Fillory?" Quentin asked the bird. That got some appreciative laughter, though he wasn't joking, and the bird didn't laugh. It didn't answer him either. Quentin couldn't read its face. Like all birds, it had only one expression. Before we go any further, each of you must pass a simple test of magical strength and skill, the bird said. Lionel here, it meant the cashier, is an expert in probability magic. Each of you will play a hand of cards with him. If you beat him, you will have passed the test. There were some disgruntled noises at this new revelation, followed by another round of discreet mutual scoping out. From the reaction, Quentin gathered that this wasn't standard practice.
"What's the game?" Plum asked.
"The game is push."
"You must be joking," iridescent glasses said disgustedly. "You really don't know anything, do you?"
Lionel had produced a pack of cards and was shuffling and bridging it fluently, without looking, his face blank.
"I know what I require," the bird said stiffly. I know that I'm offering a great deal of money for it.
Well, I didn't come here to play games.
The man stood up.
Well, why the fuck did you come here? Pixie asked brightly.
You may leave at any time, the bird said.
Maybe I will.
He walked to the door, pausing with his hand on the knob, as if he were expecting somebody to stop him. Nobody did. The door shut after him. Quentin watched Lionel shuffle. The man obviously knew how to handle a deck. The cards leapt around obligingly in his large hands, neatly and cleanly, the way they did for a pro. He thought about the entrance exam he'd taken to get into Brakebills. What was it, 13 years ago now? He hadn't been too proud to take a test then. He sure as hell wasn't now. And he used to be a bit of a pro at this himself. Cards were stage magic, close-up magic. This was where he started out.
All right, Quentin said. He got up, flexing his fingers. Let's do it.
He dragged a desk chair over noisily and sat down opposite Lionel. As a courtesy, Lionel offered him the deck. Quentin took it. He stuck to a basic shuffle, trying not to look too slick. The cards were stiff, but not brand new. They had the usual industry-standard anti-manipulation charms on them, nothing he hadn't seen before. It felt good to have them in his hands. He was back on familiar ground. Without being obvious about it, he got a look at a few face cards and put them where they wouldn't go to waste. It had been a while, a long while, but this was a game he knew something about. Back in the day, push had been a major pastime among the physical kids. It was a childishly simple game. Push was a lot like war, high card wins, with some silly added twists to break ties, toss cards into a hat, once you get five in, score it like a poker hand, etc. But the rules weren't the point. The point of push was to cheat. There was a lot of strange magic in cards. A shuffled deck wasn't a fixed thing. It was a roiling cloud of possibilities, and nothing was ever certain till the cards were actually played. It was like a box with a whole herd of Schrödinger's cats in it. With a little magical know-how, you could alter the order in which your cards came out. With a little more, you could guess what your opponent was going to play before she played it. With a bit more, you could play cards that, by all the laws of probability, rightfully belonged to your opponent, or in the discard pile, or in some other deck entirely. Quentin handed back the cards, and the game began. They started slow, trading off low cards, easy tricks, both holding serve. Quentin counted cards automatically, though there was a limit to how much good it could do. When magicians played, the cards had a way of changing sides, and cards you thought were safely deceased and out of play had a way of coming back to life. He'd been curious what caliber of talent got involved in these kinds of operations, and he was revising his estimates sharply upward. It was obvious he wasn't going to overwhelm Lionel with brute force. Quentin wondered where he'd trained. Brakebills, probably, same as he had. There was a precise, formal quality to his magic that you didn't see coming out of the safe houses. Though there was something else, too. It had a cold, sour, alien tang to it. Quentin could almost taste it. He wondered if Lionel was quite as human as he looked. There were 26 tricks in a hand of push, and halfway through, neither side had established an advantage. But on the 14th trick, Quentin overreached. He burned some of his strength to force a king to the top of his deck, only to waste it on a deuce from Lionel. The mismatch left him off balance, and he lost the next three tricks in a row. He clawed back two more by stealing cards from the discard pile, but the preliminaries were over. From here on out, it was going to be a dogfight. The room narrowed to just the table. It had been a while since Quentin had seen his competitive spirit, but it was rousing itself from its long slumber. He wasn't going to lose this thing. That wasn't going to happen. He bore down. He could feel Lionel probing, trying to shove cards around within the unplayed deck, and he shoved back. They blew all four aces in as many tricks, all out, hammer and tongs. For kicks, Quentin split his concentration and used a simple spell to twitch the sex amulet out of Lionel's pocket and onto the floor. But if that distracted Lionel, he didn't show it. Probability fields began to fluctuate crazily around them, invisible, but you could see secondary effects from them in the form of minor but very unlikely chance occurrences. Their hair and clothes stirred in impalpable breezes. A card tossed to one side might land on its edge and balance there, or spin in place on one corner. A mist formed above the table, and a single flake of snow sifted down out of it. The onlookers backed away a few steps. Quentin beat a jack of hearts with the king, then lost the next trick with the exact same cards reversed. He played a deuce, and Lionel swore under his breath when he realized he was somehow holding the extra card with the rules of poker on it. Reality was softening and melting in the heat of the game. On the second-to-last trick, Lionel played the queen of spades, and Quentin frowned. Did her face look the slightest bit like Julia's? Either way, there was no such thing as a one-eyed queen, let alone one with a bird on her shoulder. He spent his last king against it, or thought he did. When he laid it down, it had become a jack, a suicide jack at that, which again, there was no such card, especially not one with white hair, like his own. Even Lionel looked surprised. Something must be twisting the cards. It was like there was some invisible third player at the table who was toying with both of them. With his next and last card, it became clear that Lionel had lost all control over his hand because he turned over a queen of no known suit, a queen of glass. Her face was translucent, cellophane, sapphire blue. It was Alice to the life.
"What the shit?"
Lionel said, shaking his head. What the shit was right. Quentin clung to his nerve. The sight of Alice's face shook him. It froze his gut, but it also stiffened his resolve. It reminded him what he was doing here. He was not going to panic. In fact, he was going to take advantage of this. Alice was going to help him. The essence of close-up magic is misdirection. And with Lionel distracted, Quentin pulled a king of clubs out of his boot with numb fingers and slapped it down. He tried to ignore the gray suit the king wore and the branch that was sprouting in front of his face. It was over. Game and match. Quentin sat back and took a deep, shaky breath.
"Good," the bird said simply. "Next."
Lionel didn't look happy, but he didn't say anything either, just crouched down and collected his amulet from under the table. Quentin got up and went to stand against the wall with others, his knees weak, his heart still racing, revving past the red line. He was happy to get out of the game with a win, but he'd thought he would. He hadn't thought he'd see his long-lost ex-girlfriend appear on a face card. What just happened? Maybe someone here knew more about him than they should. Maybe they were trying to throw him off his game. But who? Who would bother? Nobody cared if he won or lost, not anymore. As far as he knew, the only person who cared right now was Quentin. Maybe he was doing it himself.
Maybe his own subconscious was reaching up from below and warping his spellwork. Or was it Alice herself, wherever she was, whatever she was, watching him and having a little fun? Well, let her have it. He was focused on the present. That was what mattered. He had work to do. He was getting his life back together. The past had no jurisdiction here. Not even Alice. The red-faced guy won his game with no signs of anything out of the ordinary. So did the Indian guy. The woman with the shock of white hair went out early, biting her lip as she laid down a blatantly impossible 5 deuces in a row, followed by a joker, then a go-directly-to-jail card from Monopoly. The kid got a bye for some reason. The bird didn't make him play at all. Plum got a bye, too. Pixie passed faster than any of them, either because she was that strong or because Lionel was getting tired. When it was all over, Lionel handed the woman who'd lost a brick of $100 bills for her trouble. He handed another one to the red-faced man.
"Thank you for your time," the bird said.
"Me?"
The man stared down at the money in his hand.
"But I passed!"
"Yes," Lionel said, "but you got here late, and you seem like kind of an asshole."
The man's face got even redder than it already was.
"Go ahead," Lionel said.
He spread his arms.
"Make a move."
The man's face twitched, but he wasn't so angry or so crazy that he couldn't read the odds.
"Fuck you," he said.
That was his move. He slammed the door behind him. Quentin dropped into the armchair the man had just vacated, even though it was damp from his wet windbreaker. He felt limp and wrung out. He hoped the testing was over with. He wouldn't have trusted himself to cast anything right now. Counting him, there were only 5 left. Quentin, Plum, Pixie, the Indian guy, and the kid. This all seemed a hell of a lot more real than it had half an hour ago. It wasn't too late. He could still walk away. He hadn't seen any deal-breakers yet, but he hadn't seen a lot to inspire confidence either. This could be his way back in, or it could be the road to somewhere even worse. He'd spent enough time already on things that went nowhere and left him with nothing. He could walk out back into the rainy night, back into the cold and the wet. But he didn't. It was time to turn things around. He was going to make this work. It wasn't like he had a lot of better offers.
"You think this is going to be enough?" Quentin asked the bird. "Just 5 of us?
6 with Lionel. And yes, in fact, I would say that is exactly right."
"Well, don't keep us in suspense," Pixie said. "What's the target?"
The bird didn't keep them in suspense.
"The object we are looking for is a suitcase. Brown leather, average size, manufactured 1937, monogrammed RCJ. The make is Louis Vuitton." It actually had a pretty credible French accent.
"Fancy," she said. "What's in it?"
"I do not know."
"You don't know?"
It was the first time the teenage boy had spoken.
"Why the hell do you want it, then?"
"In order to find out."
"Huh. What do the initials stand for?"
"Rupert John Chatwin," the bird said crisply.
The kid looked confused. His lips moved.
"I don't get it," he said. "Wouldn't the C come last?"
"It's a monogram, dumbass," Pixie said. "The last name goes in the middle."
The Indian guy was rubbing his chin.
"Chetwin." He was trying to place the name. "Chetwin, but isn't that—"
"It sure is," Quentin thought, though he didn't say anything. He didn't move a muscle. "It sure as hell is.
Chetwin."
That name chilled him even more than the night and the rain and the bird and the cards had. By rights, he should have gone the rest of his life without hearing it again. It had no claim on him any more, and vice versa. He and the Chatwins were through.
Except it seemed that they weren't. He'd said goodbye and buried them and mourned them. The Chatwins, Fillory, Plover, Whitespire. But there must still be some last, invisible, unbroken strand connecting them to him. Something deeper than mourning. The wound had healed, but the scar wouldn't fade, not quite. Quentin felt like an addict who'd just caught the faintest whiff of his drug of choice, the pure stuff, after a long time sober, and he felt his imminent relapse coming on with a mixture of despair and anticipation. That name was a message. A hot signal flare shot up into the night, sent specifically for him, across time and space and darkness and rain, all the way from the bright, warm center of the world. Chapter 2 It wasn't supposed to happen that way. Quentin had tried to go straight. It started in the Netherlands, the silent city of Italianate fountains and locked libraries that lies somehow behind and between everywhere else. The fountains were really doorways to other worlds, and Quentin stood leaning against the one that led to Fillory. He had just been forcibly ejected from it. He stood there for a long time, feeling the cool roughness of the stone rim. It was reassuringly solid. The fountain was his last connection to his old life, the one where he'd been a king in a magical land. He didn't want it to be over. It wouldn't really be over till he let go and walked away. He could still have it for a little longer. But no, he couldn't. It was done. He patted the fountain one more time and set off through the empty dream city. He felt weightless and empty. He'd stopped being who he was, but he wasn't sure yet who he was going to be next. His head was still full of the end of the world, the setting sun, the endless, thin, curving beach, the two mismatched wooden chairs, the ringing crescent moon, the sputtering comets. The last sight of Julia diving off the edge of Fillory straight down to the far side of the world, down into her future. It was a new beginning for her, but he'd hit a dead end. No more Fillory. No further. Though he wasn't so far gone that he didn't notice how much the Netherlands had changed. Before this, it had always been quiet and serene, trapped under a bell jar of stillness and silence beneath a cloudy twilight sky. But something had happened. The gods had come back to fix the flaw in the universe that was magic, and in the crisis that followed, the bell jar broke, and time and weather had come flooding in. Now the air smelled like mist. Ripped, ragged clouds streamed by overhead, and patches of blue sky were mirrored in shivering pools of snowmelt. The sound of trickling water was everywhere. Reluctantly, resentfully, the Netherlands was having its first spring. It was a season of wreckage and ruin. All around Quentin, roofless buildings lay open to the elements, the toppled bookshelves inside lying in domino rows, exposed like the ribs of rotting carcasses. Stray pages torn from the libraries of the Netherlands floated and tumbled high in the troubled air overhead. Crossing a bridge over a canal, Quentin saw that the water was almost level with the banks on either side. He wondered what would happen if it overflowed. Probably nothing. Probably he'd get wet. The fountain that led to Earth had changed, too. The sculpture at its center was of a great brass lotus, but in the struggle over magic, a swarm of dragons had used it to enter the Netherlands, and when they came surging up through it, the flower had ripped open at the seams. Quentin thought maybe somebody would have come by and repaired it by now. But instead the fountain was repairing itself. The old flower had withered and flopped over to one side, and a new brass lotus was budding open in its place. Quentin was studying the bud fountain, wondering if even his narrow, bony hips were narrow and bony enough to fit through it, when something brushed his shoulder. By reflex, he snatched it out of the air. It was a piece of paper, a page ripped from a book. The page was dense with writing and diagrams on both sides. He was about to let it go again, to give it back to the wind. But then he didn't. He folded it in quarters and shoved it in his back pocket instead. Then he fell to Earth. It was raining on Earth, or at least it was in Chesterton. Bucketing down, hard and freezing cold, a November New England monsoon. For reasons best known to itself, the magic button had chosen to place him in the lush Massachusetts suburb where his parents lived, on the wide, flat lawn in front of their too large house. Rain hammered on the roof and streamed down the windows and vomited out of a drainpipe in a rooster tail. It soaked through his clothes almost immediately. In the Netherlands, he'd still been able to smell the sea salt of Fillory on his clothes, but now the rain dissolved it and washed it away forever. Instead, he smelled the smells of autumn rain in the suburbs, mulch rotting, wooden decks swelling, wet dogs, hedges breathing. He took the silver watch out of his pocket, the one Elliot had given him before he left Fillory. He'd hardly glanced at it before. He'd been too shocked and angry when they told him he had to leave. But now that he did, he saw that its face was studded with a really glorious profusion of detail. Two extra dials, a moving star chart, the phases of the moon. It was a beautiful watch. He thought about how Elliot had harvested it himself from a clock sapling in the Queenswood, and then carried it and kept it safe for him during all his months at sea. It was a great gift. He wished he'd appreciated it more at the time. Though it had stopped ticking. Being on Earth didn't seem to agree with it. Maybe it was the weather. Quentin stared at his parents' darkened house for a long time, waiting to feel an urge to go inside, but the urge never came. As dark and massive as it was, the house exerted no gravitational pull on him. When he thought of his parents, it was almost like they were old lovers, so distant now that he couldn't even remember why his link to them had once seemed so real and urgent. They'd managed the neat trick of bringing up a child with whom they had absolutely nothing in common, or if there was something, none of them had ever risen to the challenge of finding it. Now they'd drifted so far apart that the silver thread connecting them had simply snapped. If he had a home anywhere, it wasn't here. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes, and chanted four long, low syllables under his breath, while at the same time making a big circle with his left hand. The rain began sheeting off an invisible lens over his head, and he felt, if not drier, then at least that he had taken the first step on the long and arduous path to dryness. Then he walked away down the wide, wet, suburban sidewalk. He was out of Fillory, and he wasn't a king anymore. It was time to start living his damn life like everybody else. Better late than never. Quentin walked half an hour to the center of Chesterton, caught a bus from there to Alewife, took a subway to South Station, and got on a Greyhound bus bound for Newburgh, New York, north of Manhattan on the Hudson River, which was the closest you could get to Brakebills via public transportation. Coming back was easier this time. Last time he'd been with Julia, and he'd been panicked and desperate. This time he was in no particular hurry, and he knew exactly what he needed, to be somewhere safe and familiar, where he had something to do, where people knew magic and knew him. What he needed was a job. He stayed at the same motel as last time, then took a taxi to the same bend in the road and picked his way in through the damp forest from there. It had rained here, too, and every twig and branch he brushed soaked him all over again with cold water. He didn't bother with any fancy visualization spells this time. He figured they would see him, and that when they did, they would know him for what he was.
He was right.
Quentin spotted it a long way off through the trees, just a stray patch of sunlight on an otherwise overcast day. As he got closer, it resolved itself into an oval of lighter, brighter air hanging there among the wet branches. The oval framed a woman's disembodied head and shoulders like a cameo in a locket. She was 40-ish, with almond-shaped eyes, and though he didn't recognize her, she had the unmistakably alert air of a fellow practitioner.
"Hi," Quentin said, when he was close enough that he didn't have to shout.
"I'm Quentin."
"I know," she said. "You coming in?"
"Thanks."
She did something, made a small gesture somewhere out of view, and the portrait went full length. She was standing in an archway of summer light and grass carved out of the gloomy autumn forest. She stood aside to let him pass.
"Thanks," he said again.
When the summer air hit him, tears of relief prickled unexpectedly at the corners of his eyes. He blinked and turned away, but the woman caught it.
"It never gets old, does it?"
"No," he said. "It really doesn't." Quentin went the long way around, bypassing the maze. It would have been redrawn 10 times over since the last time he knew it, and walked up to the house. The halls were quiet. It was August here, and there were no students to speak of, though if they hadn't filled the incoming class yet, they might still be holding entrance exams. Early afternoon sunlight fell undisturbed on the much-abused carpets in the common rooms. The whole building felt like it was resting and recovering after the catastrophe of the school year. He didn't know what to expect from fog. The last time they spoke, they hadn't parted on the best possible terms. But Quentin was here, and he was going to make his case. He found the dean in his office going through admissions files.
"Well!" Still groomed and goateed, the older man made a show of surprise. "Come in. I didn't expect to see you back so soon."
Fogg smiled, though he didn't get up. Quentin sat down, cautiously. "I wasn't expecting it either," he said, "but it's good to be here."
"That's always nice to hear. Last time I saw you, I believe you had a hedge witch in tow. Tell me, did she get wherever it was she was going?"
"She had, though by a long and circuitous route, and Quentin didn't want to go into detail about it. Instead, he inquired after the fortunes of the Brakebills Welters team, and Fogg filled him in on that in all the detail he could have wanted, and more. Quentin asked after the little metal bird that used to inhabit his office, and Fogg explained that someone had made it their doctoral project to turn it back into flesh and feathers. Fogg took out a cigar and offered one to Quentin. Quentin accepted it. They smoked. It was all going more smoothly than he'd expected. He'd formed an idea of Fogg as a petty, spiteful tyrant, but now he began to wonder if the dean had changed, or if he'd gotten it wrong in the first place. Maybe Fogg wasn't as bad as all that. Maybe he, Quentin, had always been a bit too sensitive and defensive around him. When Fogg asked Quentin how he could help him, Quentin told him. And just like that, Fogg helped him. As luck would have it, there was a vacancy in the faculty at the most junior level. A week earlier, an incoming adjunct had had to be dismissed after it came out that he'd plagiarized most of his master's thesis from Francis Bacon. Quentin could pick up his teaching load if he liked. Really, he'd be doing Fogg a favor. If there was any schadenfreude there, if Fogg took any pleasure from the sight of a newly chastened and humbled Quentin, the high-flying, adventure-having, mischief-managing prodigal son coming crawling back for a handout, he hid it well.
"Don't look so surprised, Quentin," he said. "You were always one of the clever ones. Everyone saw it but you. If you hadn't been so busy trying to convince yourself you didn't belong here, you would have seen it too."
Just as it had years ago, Brakebills opened its doors to him, took him into itself, and offered him a place in its little secret hideaway world. From a pegboard, Fogg gave him the keys to a room so small and with a ceiling so high that it was not unlike living at the bottom of an air shaft. It had a desk and a window and a bathroom and a bed, a narrow twin bed that had lost its twin. Its sheets had the unmistakable scent of Brakebill's laundry, and the smell immediately sent Quentin dropping like a stone down a well of memory, back to the years he'd spent sleeping snugly wrapped up in Brakebill's bedclothes, dreaming of a future very different from the one he now inhabited. It wasn't nostalgia, exactly. Quentin didn't miss the old days, but he did miss Fillory. It was only when he was finally alone in his room, not a king's room, a teacher's room, a very junior teacher's room, with the door shut, that Quentin allowed himself to really, truly long for it. He yearned for it. He felt the full force of what he'd lost. He lay down and stared up at the faraway ceiling and thought of everything that was happening there without him, the journeys and adventures and feasts and all the various magical wonders all across the length and breadth of Fillory, the rivers and oceans and trees and meadows, and he wanted to be there so badly that it felt like his desire should be enough to physically pull him out of his flat, hard bed, out of this world and into the one he belonged in. But it wasn't, and it didn't. They gave him a teaching schedule. They gave him a seat in the dining room and the authority to discipline students. They also gave him something he should have gotten long ago, something he'd almost forgotten he didn't have, a discipline. Every magician had a natural predisposition to a certain specific kind of magic. Sometimes it was something trivial, sometimes it was genuinely useful, but everyone had one. It was a kind of sorcerer's fingerprint. But they'd never been able to find Quentin's. As part of his induction into the Brakebill's faculty, Quentin was required to state his discipline, at which point it occurred to him that he still didn't know what it was. Just as they had a dozen years ago, they sent him to Professor Sunderland, a woman with whom he'd been seethingly, volcanically infatuated when he was an undergraduate. She met him in the same long, sunlit lab she'd worked in back then. It was weird to think that she'd been here this whole time while he'd been off careening disastrously around the multiverse, and that they were now, for most practical purposes, peers. If anything, she was even more beautiful than she had been at 25. Her face had ripened and softened. She looked more like herself, though what he'd thought of at the time as her serene, otherworldly quality now felt a bit more like a slight lack of affect. He hadn't noticed how withdrawn and shut down she was. He'd felt so far below her then, he wasn't sure she'd even remember him. But she did. "Of course I do. You weren't quite as invisible as you thought you were." Had he thought that? Probably he had. "Does that mean my secret crush on you wasn't as secret as I thought it was?" She smiled, but not unkindly. "The concealment of crushes probably isn't your discipline," she said. "Roll up your sleeves above your elbows. Let me see the backs of your hands." He showed her. She gave them a brisk rub with fine powder, and an irregular pattern of tiny cold sparks appeared on his skin, like a sparsely populated countryside seen from above by night. He thought he felt a web of icy prickles, too, though that could have been his imagination. She chewed her lip, studying him. Then she tapped his hands, one, two, like a child playing a game, and the sparks went out. There was nothing there that interested Professor Sunderland. Or Pearl. Now that they were colleagues, he should get in the habit of calling her by her first name. She snipped a lock of his hair and burned it in a brazier. It smelled like burning hair. She scrutinized the smoke. "Nope." Now that the pleasantries were out of the way, she was all business. He could have been a tricky flower arrangement that she couldn't get quite right. She studied him through a graduated series of smoked lenses while he walked backward around the room. Why do you think this is so difficult? Quentin asked, trying not to run into anything.
Don't look over your shoulder.
My discipline. Why do you think it's so hard to figure out?
Could be a few things. She smoothed her straight blonde hair back behind her ears and switched lenses. It could be occluded. Some disciplines, just by their natures, don't want to be found. Some are just really minor. Pointless, really, and it's hard to pick them out of the background noise.
Right. Though it could also be... He stumbled over a stool.
Because it's something interesting? That no one's ever seen before? Sure. Why not?
He'd always envied Penny his fancy and apparently unique discipline, which was interdimensional travel. But from her tone, he suspected she could have listed a few reasons why not.
Remember when I made those sparks that one time?
I remember.
Aha! I can't believe I didn't think of this before. Stand still.
He stopped. And Pearl rummaged in a drawer and took out a heavy, brass-edged ruler marked in irregular units that Quentin didn't recognize.
Close your eyes.
He did, and immediately an electric bar of pain flashed across the back of his right hand. He clamped it between his knees. It was 10 seconds before he even recovered enough to say, "Ow!" When he opened his eyes, he half expected to see his fingers sheared right off at the second knuckle. They were still there, though they were turning red. She'd whacked them with the sharp edge of the ruler.
"Sorry," she said. "The pain response is often very revealing."
"Listen, if that doesn't do it, I think I'm all right with not knowing."
"No, that did it. You're very sensitive, I must say."
Quentin didn't think that not wanting to get smacked across the knuckles with a ruler made him unusually sensitive, but he didn't say anything, and Pearl was already paging through a huge old reference book printed all in jewel type. Quentin had a sudden crazy urge to stop her. He'd been living with this for so long. It was part of who he was. He was the man without a discipline. Was he ready to give that up? If she told him, he'd be like everybody else. But he didn't stop her.
"I had a pet theory about you," Pearl ran her finger down a column, "which was that I couldn't find your discipline last time because you didn't have one yet. I always thought you were a bit young for your age. Personality is a factor, maturity. You were old enough to have a discipline, but emotionally you weren't there yet. You hadn't come into focus."
That was kind of embarrassing. And, like his crush, it had probably been obvious to more people than he realized. "I guess I'm a late bloomer," Quentin said.
"There you are," she tapped the page. "Repair of small objects. That's you."
"Repair of small objects."
"Uh-huh."
He couldn't honestly say that it was everything he'd hoped for.
"Small like a chair?" "Think smaller," she said. "Like, I don't know, a coffee cup."
She shaped her hands around an invisible mug.
"Have you had any special luck with that? Lesser bindings, reconstitutions, that kind of thing?"
"Maybe, I don't know." He couldn't actually say that he'd ever noticed. Maybe he just hadn't been paying attention. It was a bit of an anticlimax. You couldn't call it sexy, exactly. Not breaking new ground so much. He wouldn't be striding between dimensions or calling down thunderbolts or manifesting patroni, not on the strength of repair of small objects. Life was briskly and efficiently stripping Quentin of his last delusions about himself one by one, shucking them off in firm, hard jerks like wet clothes, leaving him naked and shivering. But it wasn't going to kill him. It wasn't sexy, but it was real, and that was what mattered now. No more fantasies. That was life after Fillory. Maybe when you give up your dreams, you find out that there's more to life than dreaming. He was going to live in the real world from now on, and he was going to learn to appreciate its rough, mundane solidity. He'd been learning a lot about himself lately, and he'd thought it would be painful, and it was, but it was a relief, too. These were things he'd been scared to face his whole life, and now that he was looking them in the eye, they weren't quite as scary as he thought. Or maybe he was tougher than he thought. At any rate, he wouldn't have to be retroactively expelled from the physical kids. Repair of small